This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Flush by Carl Hyacinth. Read for you by Michael Welch. One. The deputy told me to empty my pockets. 2 quarters, a penny, a stick of bubble gum, and a roll of grip tape for my skateboard. It was pitiful. Go on inside, he's waiting for you, the deputy said. My dad was sitting alone at a bare metal table. He looked pretty good, all things considered. He wasn't even handcuffed. Happy Father's Day, I said. He stood up and gave me a hug. Thanks, Noah, he said. In the room there was another deputy, a broad, jowly bear standing next to the door that led to the jail cells. I guess his job was to make sure I wasn't smuggling a hacksaw to my father so that he could break out. It's good they let you keep your own clothes, I said to Dad. I figured they'd make you put on one of those dorky uniforms. I'm sure they will, sooner or later, he shrugged. You doing okay? How come you won't let Mom bail you out, I asked. Because it's important for me to be here right now. Important how? She says you'll lose your job if you stay locked up. Well, she's probably right, my dad admitted. He'd been driving a taxi for the past year and a half. Before that, he was a fishing guide, a good one, too, until the Coast Guard took away his captain's license. He said, Noah, it's not like I robbed a bank or something. I know, Dad. Did you see what I did? Not yet, I said. He gave me a wink. It's impressive. Yeah, I bet. He was in a surprisingly good mood. I'd never been to a jail before, though honestly it wasn't much of a jail. 2 holding cells, my dad told me. The main county lockup was miles away in Key West. Mom wants to know if she should call the lawyer, I said. I suppose. The same one from last time? She wasn't sure. Yeah, he's all right, my father said. His clothes were rumpled, and he looked tired, but he said the food was decent and the police were treating him fine. Dad, what if you just said you're sorry and offered to pay for what you did? But I'm not sorry for what I did, Noah. The only thing I'm sorry about is that you've got to see me locked up like an axe murderer. The other times my dad had gotten in trouble, they wouldn't let me come to the jail because I was too young. I'm not a common criminal. Dad reached across and put a hand on my arm. I know right from wrong, good from bad. Sometimes I just get carried away. Nobody thinks you're a criminal. Well, Dusty Muehlman sure does. That's because you sunk his boat, I pointed out. If you just paid to get it fixed, maybe then... That's a 73-footer, my dad cut in. You've got to know what you're doing to sink one of those pigs. You ought to have a look. Maybe later, I said. The deputy standing by the door made a grunting noise and held up 5 chubby fingers, which was the number of minutes left before he took my father back to the cell. Is your mom still ticked off at me? Dad asked. What do you think? I tried to explain it to her, but she wouldn't listen. Then maybe you can explain it to me, I said. I'm old enough to understand. Dad smiled. I believe you are, Noah. My father was born and raised here in Florida, so he grew up on the water. His dad, my Grandpa Bobby, ran a charter boat out of Hallover Marina on Miami Beach. Grandpa Bobby passed away when I was little, so I honestly didn't remember him. We'd heard different stories about what happened. One was that his appendix burst. Another was that he got hurt real bad in a bar fight. All we knew for sure is that he took his fishing boat down to South America on some sort of job, and he never came back. One day, a man from the U.S. State Department showed up at our house and told my parents that Grandpa Bobby was dead and buried near some little village in Colombia. For some weird reason, they couldn't bring his body home for a funeral. I knew this because I'd seen the paperwork. My dad kept a file, and at least 4 or 5 times a year, he would write to Washington, D.C., asking someone to please help get his father's coffin back to Florida. This is, like, 10 years later. Mom worked with my dad on the letters. She's a legal secretary, and she gets straight to the point. My mom and dad first met while they were standing in line to pay speeding tickets at the Dade County Courthouse, and they got married 6 weeks later. I know this for a fact because Mom put the speeding tickets in a scrapbook along with their wedding pictures and stuff like that. The ticket that my mom got was for driving 44 miles an hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone. My father's ticket was much worse. He was doing 93 on the turnpike. In the album, Dad's ticket looked sort of lumpy and wrinkled because he'd crumpled it into a ball when the state trooper handed it to him. My mother said she had to use a laundry iron to flatten it out before pasting it next to hers in the scrapbook. About a year after, they got married. My parents moved down to the Keys. I'm sure this was Dad's idea because he'd been coming here ever since he was a kid, and he hated the big city. I was actually born in a 1989 Chevrolet Caprice on U.S. Highway 1, my dad racing up the 18-mile stretch from Key Largo to the mainland. He was trying to get my mother to the hospital in Homestead. She was lying in the back seat of the car, and that's where I was born. Mom did it all by herself. She didn't tell my dad to pull over and stop because she didn't want him interfering. They still argue about this. She says he's got a tendency to get overexcited, which is the understatement of the century. He didn't even realize I was born until they got to Florida City and I started bawling. Abby came along 3 years later. Dad talked my mom into naming her after one of his favorite writers, some weirdo bird who's buried out west in the middle of a desert. Most of my friends aren't crazy about their sisters, but Abby's all right. Maybe it's not cool to say so, but the truth is the truth. She's funny and tough and not nearly as irritating as most of the girls at school. Over the years, Abby and I developed a pretty good system. She keeps an eye on Mom and I keep an eye on Dad. Sometimes, though, I need extra help. So what's the deal? Abby asked after I got back from the jail. We were sitting at the kitchen table. For lunch, Mom had fixed us the usual, ham and cheese sandwiches. He says he got carried away again, I said. Abby raised her eyebrows and snorted. No duh. Mom set two glasses of milk on the table. Noah, why does he insist on staying in jail? It's Father's Day, for heaven's sake. I guess he's trying to make a point. All he's making, my sister said, is a jackass of himself. Hush, Abby, Mom told her. He said it's okay to call the lawyer, I added. He's not pleading guilty, Abby asked. How can he not plead guilty? He did it, didn't he? It's still smart to have an attorney, said my mother. She seemed much calmer now. When the police first called, she'd gotten real mad and said some pretty harsh things about Dad. Honestly, I couldn't blame her. Even for him, this was a major screw-up. Noah, how are you doing? She asked. I knew she was worried that the jailhouse visit had shaken me up, so I told her I was fine. She said, I'm sure it wasn't easy seeing your father behind bars. They brought him to a private room, I said. He wasn't even wearing handcuffs. My mother frowned slightly. Still, it's not a happy picture. Abby said, maybe you ought to plead insanity. Mom ignored her. Your father has many good qualities, she said to me, but he's not the most stable role model for a young man like yourself. He'd be the first to admit it, Noah. Whenever I get this speech, I listen patiently and don't say a word. She won't come right out and say so, but Mom worries that I'm too much like my dad. Drink your milk, she said, and went to the den to call our lawyer, a man named Mr. Shine. As soon as we were alone, Abby reached over and twisted the hair on my arm. Tell me everything, she said. Not now, I jerked my head toward the doorway. Not with Mom around. Abby said, it's all right, she's on the phone. I shook my head and firmly took a bite of my sandwich. Noah, are you holding out on me, my sister asked. Finish your lunch, I said. Then we'll go for a ride. The Coral Queen had gone down stern first in 12 feet of water. Her hull had settled on the marly bottom at a slight angle with the bow aiming upward. She was a big one, too. Even at high tide, the top two decks were above the waterline. It was like a big, ugly apartment building had fallen out of the sky and landed in the basin. Abby hopped off my handlebars and walked to the water's edge. She planted her hands on her hips and stared at the crime scene. Whoa, she said. He really did it this time. It's bad, I agreed. The Coral Queen was one of those gambling boats where passengers line up to play blackjack and electronic poker and to stuff their faces at the all-you-can-eat buffet. It didn't sound like a ton of fun to me, but the Coral Queen was packed to the rafters every night. There was one major difference between Dusty Muehlman's operation and the gambling cruises up in Miami. The Coral Queen didn't actually go anywhere. That's one reason it was so popular. By Florida law, gambling boats are supposed to travel at least 3 miles offshore, beyond the state boundaries, before anyone is allowed to start betting. Rough weather is real bad for business because lots of customers get seasick. As soon as they start throwing up, they quit spending money. According to my father, Dusty Muehlman's dream was to open a gambling boat that never left the calm and safety of its harbor. That way, the passengers would never get too queasy to party. Only Indian tribes are allowed to run casino operations in Florida, so Dusty somehow persuaded a couple of rich Miccosukees from Miami to buy the marina and make it part of their reservation. Dad said the government raised a stink, but later backed off because the Indians had better lawyers. Anyway, Dusty got his gambling boat, and he got rich. My dad had waited until 3 a.m. when the last of the crew was gone to sneak aboard. He'd untied the ropes and started one of the engines and idled out to the mouth of the basin, where he'd opened the seacocks and cut the hoses and disconnected the bilge pumps and then dived overboard. The Coral Queen had gone down crosswise in the channel, which meant that no other vessels could get in or out of the basin. In other words, Dusty Muehlman wasn't the only captain in town who wanted to strangle my dad on Father's Day. I locked my bike to a buttonwood tree and walked down to the charter docks, Abby trailing behind. Two small skiffs and a Coast Guard inflatable were nosing around the Coral Queen. We could hear the men in the skiffs talking about what had to be done to float the boat. It was a major project.
"He's lost his marbles," Abby muttered.
"Who, Dad?"
"No way," I said.
"Then why did he do it?"
"Because Dusty Muehlman has been dumping his holding tank into the water," I said.
Abby grimaced.
"Yuck! From the toilets?"
"Yep. In the middle of the night, when there's nobody around."
"That is so gross."
"And totally illegal," I said. "He only does it to save money." According to my father, Dusty Muehlman was such a pathetic cheapskate that he wouldn't pay to have the Coral Queen sewage hauled away. Instead, his crew had standing orders to flush the waste into the basin, which was already murky. The tide later carried most of the filth out to the open water.
"But why didn't Dad just call the Coast Guard?" my sister asked.
"Wouldn't that have been the grown-up thing to do?"
"He told me he tried. He said he called everybody he could think of, but they could never catch Dusty in the act," I said.
"Dad thinks somebody's tipping him off."
"Oh, please," Abby groaned.
Now she was starting to annoy me.
"When the wind and the current are right, the poop from the gambling boat floats out of the basin and down the shoreline," I said. "Straight to Thunder Beach."
Abby made a pukey face.
"Ugh! So that's why they close the park sometimes. You know how many kids go swimming there? What Dusty's doing can make you real sick at both ends. Hospital sick, Dad says. So it's not only disgusting, it's dangerous."
"Yeah, but I didn't say it was right, Abby, what Dad did. I'm only telling you why." My father hadn't even tried to get away. After swimming back to the dock, he'd sat down in a folding chair, opened a can of root beer, and watched the Coral Queen go down. He was still there at dawn, sleeping, when the police arrived.
"So what now?" Abby asked.
A dark bluish slick surrounded the boat, and the men in the Coast Guard inflatable were laying out yellow floating bumpers to keep the oil and grease from spreading. By sinking the Coral Queen, my father himself had managed to make quite a mess. I said,
"Dad asked me to help him."
Abby made a face.
"Help him what? Break out of jail?"
"Get serious."
"Then what, Noah? Tell me."
I knew she wasn't going to like it. "He wants me to help him nail Dusty Muehlman," I said. A long silence followed, so I figured Abby was thinking up something snarky to say. But it turned out that she wasn't. "I didn't give Dad an answer yet," I said.
"I already know your answer," said my sister. "His heart's in the right place, Abby. It really is."
"It's not his heart I'm worried about. It's his brain," she said.
"You'd better be careful, Noah."
"Are you going to tell Mom?"
"I haven't decided."
She gave me a sideways look that told me she probably wouldn't. Like I said, my sister's all right. 2. Lucky for us, it was summertime and school was out. That meant that Abby and I didn't have to face all the other kids at once. It's a pretty small town and news gets around fast, so by now it was no secret that our father was in the slammer for sinking Dusty Muehlman's casino boat. Everybody would be talking about it. The kid I most didn't want to see was Jasper Muehlman Jr., who was Dusty's son. He was a well-known jerk, which I partly blamed on the fact that his parents had named him Jasper. That would be enough to make anybody mean and mad at the world. Unfortunately, he was at the marina the next morning when I stopped by to see the salvage crew float the Coral Queen. Scuba divers were feeding fat black hoses into the sunken half of the boat, though I couldn't tell if they were pumping water out or pumping air in. I spotted Jasper Jr. before he spotted me, but for some reason I didn't sneak away. I just stood around watching the divers wrestle with the hoses until Jasper Jr. came over and called me a name that wasn't very original. "I'm sorry about what happened to your dad's boat," I said, trying my hardest to sound sincere. When Jasper Jr. shoved me, I wasn't totally surprised. He isn't a big kid, but he's wiry and strong, and he likes to fight. It's one of the only things he does well.
"Lay off," I said, and naturally he pushed me again.
"Your crazy father sunk our boat," Jasper Jr. snarled.
"I said I was sorry. You're gonna pay for this, Underwood."
Normally I try to stick to the truth, but I wasn't in the mood to get punched in the face, which is what Jasper Jr. had in mind. So, to calm him down, I said, "I just came by to see if I could help."
"I'm so sure.
Honest." Jasper Jr. sneered, which is another thing he's good at. I found myself studying the shape of his head, which reminded me of an extra-large walnut. He wore his hair in a buzz cut, and you could see shiny lumps and crinkles in the skin of his scalp. Maybe everybody's skull is knobby and weird underneath their hair, but on Jasper Jr. it made him look even meaner. He said, "Underwood,
I'm gonna kick your butt from here to Miami.
I don't think so.
Yeah? And why don't you think so, dork face?
Because your dad's about to come over here and kick yours, I said, which was true. Dusty Muehlman had been hollering for his son from the other side of the basin. Jasper Jr. hadn't heard him because he was too busy messing with me, and now his father was seriously ticked off. I pointed across the water to where Dusty Muehlman stood glaring, his arms folded. Jasper Jr. spun around and saw for himself.
Uh-oh, he said, and took off running to join his father. I'll get you later, he hollered at me over one shoulder.
A few minutes later, Abby showed up, and we hung around until the Coral Queen was off the bottom. We were surprised to see how easily they got her up, but of course there weren't any holes in the hull or other damage that needed patching. My father had just pulled the plugs, basically.
How does Dad know it's the casino boat doing the dumping? Abby asked.
Because they never had to close Thunder Beach before the Coral Queen got here. They never had a problem with poop in the water until now, I said. A small crowd had gathered to see the operation, but Abby and I stayed off by ourselves, on the far side of the basin. We didn't want to make Dusty Muehlman any madder than he already was.
What a phony, my sister said. Just look at him.
At one time, Dusty Muehlman had been an ordinary fishing guide, the same as my father. Their skiffs were berthed next to each other, at a place called Ted's Marina. In the summertime, when business slowed down, Dusty would head out to Colorado and work at a dude ranch, taking tourists into the mountains for brook trout. Then, one September, he came back to the Keys and put his skiff up for sale. He told Dad and the other guides that he'd inherited some money from a rich uncle who died in an elephant stampede in Africa. I remember Mom's eyes narrowing when Dad told us the story. It was the same look I get whenever I tell her I'm done with my homework and she knows better. As for my father, he said anything was possible, even Dusty Muehlman being related to a dead millionaire. Not long after he quit guiding, Dusty bought the Coral Queen, got her outfitted for gambling, and partnered up with the Miccosukees. That wasn't even 2 years ago, and now he was one of the richest men in Monroe County, or so he said. He drove up and down Highway 1 in a black Cadillac SUV, and he wore bright flowered shirts and smoked real Cuban cigars just to let the world know what a big shot he was. But according to Dad, Dusty still showed up every night at the casino boat to count the money personally. Abby said, Muehlman will have the tub fixed up good as new in a week. What was Dad thinking? If he was serious, he would have burned the darn thing to the waterline.
Don't give him any ideas, I said.
Lice Peaking lived in a trailer park on the old road that runs parallel to the main highway. I got there at lunchtime, but he was still asleep. When I offered to come back later, his girlfriend said no. She'd be happy to wake him. She was a large lady with bright blonde hair and a barbed wire tattoo around one of her biceps. My dad had told me about her. He said to make sure I was extra polite. The girlfriend disappeared down the hallway and came back a half a minute later, leading Lice Peaking by his belt. He didn't look so good, and he smelled even worse. A combination of beer and B.O. was my guess.
Who are you? He demanded,
then sagged down on an old sofa. The girlfriend said, I'm off to the store.
Don't forget my cigarettes, Lice Peaking told her.
No way, you promised to quit.
Oh, give me a break, Shelley.
They argued for a while and seemed to forget they had company. I pretended to look at the aquarium, which had pea-green slime on the glass and exactly one live fish swimming in the water. Finally, Lice Peaking's girlfriend said he was hopeless and snatched the wallet out of his jeans and stomped out the door. When he got himself together, he asked me once more who I was.
Noah Underwood, I said. Payne's boy?
That's right. He asked me to come see you.
About what?
Mr. Muehlman, I said. From Lice Peaking's throat came a sound that was either a chuckle or a cough. He fished under one of the sofa cushions until he found a half-smoked, mushed-up cigarette, which he balanced in a crusty corner of his mouth.
I don't suppose you got a match, he said.
No, sir. He dragged himself to the kitchenette and knocked around until he came up with a lighter. He fired up the old moldy butt and sucked on it for a solid minute without even glancing in my direction. The smoke was making me sick to my stomach, but I couldn't leave until I got an answer. For 2 years, until last Christmas Eve, Lice Peaking had worked as a mate on Dusty Muehlman's casino boat. Mr. Peaking, I said. His real name was Charles, but Dad said everyone called him Lice, for obvious reasons, since elementary school. It didn't look like his bathing habits had improved much since then.
What do you want, boy? He snapped.
It's about the Coral Queen. My dad says Mr. Muehlman is dumping the holding tank into the marina basin. Lice Peaking propped himself against the wall of the trailer.
Really? Well, let's just say that's true. What's it got to do with you or me or the price of potatoes? My father's in jail, I said, for sinking that boat. Aw, go on. I'm serious. I thought everybody'd heard by now. Vice Peking started laughing so hard I thought he might have an asthma attack and fall on the floor. Obviously, the news about my father had brightened his day. Please, I said, will you help us? He stopped laughing and snuffed the nub of his cigarette on the countertop. Now why would I do a dumb fool thing like that? Help you do what? I explained how the toilet scum from the gambling boat flowed down to the shoreline to Thunder Beach. Where the turtles lay their eggs, I said, and all the kids go swimming. Vice Peking shrugged. Say I was to help you. What's in it for me? Dad had warned me that Lice Peking wasn't accustomed to doing something simply because it was decent and right. He'd predicted that Lice Peking might demand something in return. We don't have much, I said. Oh, that's too bad. He made like he was playing a violin. I knew money would be tight at our house as long as Dad was in jail. My mother only works part-time at the law firm, so the pay isn't so hot. What about my dad's truck, I asked. It's a 97 Dodge pickup. Giving it up was my father's idea. No, I already got wheels, Lice Peking said. Anyway, not supposed to drive on account of they yank my license. What else? I thought of offering him Dad's fishing skiff, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. It was a cool little boat. Let me talk to my father, I said. You do that. Will you at least promise to think about it? You listen here, Lice Peking said. What do I care about baby sea turtles? I got my own daily survival to worry about. He pointed to the door and followed me out. I was halfway down the steps of the trailer before I got up the nerve to ask one more question. How come you don't work for Mr. Muehlman anymore? Because he fired me, Lice Peking said. Didn't your old man tell you? No, sir, he didn't. To keep from wobbling, Lice Peking braced himself with both arms in the doorway. His face was pasty in the sunlight, and his eyes were glassy and dim. He looked like a sick old iguana, yet according to my dad, he was only 29. It was hard to believe. Ain't you gonna ask me why I got canned, he said. It was for stealing. Did you do it? Yep, I sure did. How much, I asked. Lice Peking grinned. It wasn't money I stole from Dusty, he said. It was Shelley. Oh. What can I say? I needed a lady with a big heart and a valid driver's license. I said, I'll be back after I see my father. Whatever, said Lice Peking. I'm gonna hunt down a beer. My mother says that being married to my father is like having another child to watch after, one who's too big and unpredictable to put in time out. Sometimes, when Mom and Dad are arguing, she threatens to pack up our stuff and take me and Abby out of the Keys to go start a normal life. I think my mother loves my dad, but she just can't understand him. Abby says Mom understands him perfectly fine, but she just can't figure out how to fix him. When I got back from the trailer park, my mom was in the kitchen chopping up onions. That's how I knew she'd been crying. Nobody in our family likes onions, and the only time Mom ever fixes them is when she's upset. That way she can tell Abby and me that it's only the onions making her eyes water. I knew she'd been to the jail, so I asked, "How's Dad?" My mother didn't look up. "Oh, he's just dandy," she said. "Is there any news?" "What do you mean, Noah?" "About when he's getting out." "Well, that's entirely up to him," Mom said. "I've offered to put up his bail, but apparently he'd rather sit alone in a cramped, roach-infested cell than be home with his family. Maybe the lawyer can talk some sense into him." Of course, I couldn't tell her what my father had asked me to do. She would have raced back to the jail, reached through the bars, and throttled him. "Think they'll let me visit him again?" I asked. "I don't see why not. It isn't as if his social schedule is all booked up." From the tone of her voice, I knew she was highly irritated with my father. "I spoke to your Aunt Sandy and your Uncle Dell," she said. "They offered to call him in jail and try to talk some sense into him, but I told them not to bother." Aunt Sandy and Uncle Dell are Dad's older sister and brother. They live in Miami Beach, Sandy in a high-rise condominium with a gym on the top floor, and Dell in a nice house with a tennis court in the backyard. This is a sensitive subject at her home. Several years after my grandfather disappeared in South America, a large amount of money was discovered in a safe deposit box that he'd kept at a bank up in Hallandale. Nobody ever told Abby or me exactly how much was there, but it must have been a lot. I remember Dad talking about it with my mother, who always wondered how a charter boat captain could afford to put away so much cash. She had a point, too. Nobody we knew ever got rich in the fishing business. Anyway, Grandpa Bobby had left instructions that the money was to be split evenly among Sandy, Dell, and my father, but Dad wouldn't take a nickel. My mother didn't argue about it either, which made me think there must have been a good reason for steering clear of that cash. Aunt Sandy and Uncle Dell were more than happy to take Dad's share, and they've been living the high life ever since. They wanted to send some hot-shot Miami lawyer down to handle his case, Mom said, but I told them it wasn't necessary. You're right. It's not such a big deal. That's not what I said, Noah. It is a big deal. She scraped the chopped onion bits into a bowl, which she covered with plastic wrap and placed into the refrigerator. Later, when she was alone in the kitchen, she would empty the whole thing into the garbage. I'm at the end of my rope with your father, she said. Mom, everything's gonna work out. You children need to have food on the table. The mortgage needs to be paid, she went on angrily. Meanwhile, he's sitting in jail, talking about fighting for his principles. He wants to be a martyr, Noah, that's fine, but not at the expense of this family. I won't stand for it. Mom, I know it's a rough time, I said, but she cut me off with a wave of her hand. Go clean up your room, she said, please. Abby was waiting at the top of the stairs. She put a finger to her lips and led me down the hall to my parents' bedroom. She cracked open the door and pointed. There, lying open on the bed, was my mother's suitcase. Not her vacation suitcase either, but the big plaid one. Uh-oh, I said in a whisper. Abby nodded gravely. She's serious this time, Noah. We've got to do something. 3. By the time they let me visit my father again, the Coral Queen had been pumped dry, mopped clean, and refitted with new gambling equipment. I was hoping Dad wouldn't ask about it, but he did. No way, he exclaimed when I told him that Dusty Muehlman was back in action. They must have had 20 guys working on that boat, I said. My father was crushed. I should have taken it out and sunk it in Hawk's Channel, he muttered, or the Gulf Stream. Luckily, we were alone in the interview room. I assumed that my father had convinced the big jolly deputy, and probably everyone else at the jail, that he was harmless and fairly normal. He was good at that. Mom heard you might get transferred to the stockade in Key West, I said. Not anymore, Dad reported in a confidential tone. The lieutenant here likes me. I'm teaching him how to play chess. You play chess? Shh, my father said. He thinks I do. Hey, how's Abby? All right, I said. Tell her to hang in there, Noah. She says you need professional help. Dad sat back and chortled. That's our girl. Did you go see lice peeking? I described my visit to the trailer park. My father wasn't surprised that Lice turned down the old truck and wanted money in exchange for providing evidence against Dusty Muehlman. Dad, how are we going to pay him when we're flat broke? Excellent question, my father said. See if Lice will take my bonefish skiff. It's worth 10 or 12 grand at least. Secretly, I'd been hoping that one day Dad would give me that boat. It was an original Hell's Bay with a 60-horse Merc, a really sweet ride. Sometimes, late in the afternoon, my father would take me and Abby out fishing. Even if the snappers weren't biting, we'd stay until sunset, hoping to see the green flash on the horizon. The flash was kind of a legend in the Keys. Some people believed in it and some didn't. Dad claimed that he'd actually witnessed it once, on a cruise to Fort Jefferson. For our fishing expeditions, either Abby or I always brought a camera, just in case. We had a stack of pretty sunset pictures, but no green flash. You sure you want to give away the skiff? I asked. What the heck? It's the best we can do, Dad said. I guess so. I tried not to sound too bummed. Hey, did you meet the famous Shelley? Yeah, she's kind of scary, I said. Lice said he stole her from Dusty. What does that mean exactly? I figured it was one of those I'll-explain-it-when-you're-older questions that my dad would brush off, but he didn't. Shelley was Dusty's second or third wife after Jasper Jr.'s mother, he said. Then he paused. Actually, maybe they were only engaged to be married. Anyway, one day she got fed up with Dusty and moved in with Lice. I wondered how miserable life with the Muehlmans must have been to make Lice Peeking look like a prize. Dad, when are you coming home? I asked. After the trial, he replied. The plan was to use his big day in court to expose Dusty Muehlman's illegal polluting. But Mom says you can bail out and come home and still have your trial later, I said. No, I need to stay here and show I'm totally committed to the cause. You know how many jails around this world are full of people who spoke up for what they believed in and lost their freedom, lost everything they had? Look at Nelson Mandela, my father said. He spent 27 years in a South African prison. 27 years, Noah. A couple of weeks won't hurt me.
But Mom misses you, I said. That seemed to catch him off guard and take the steam out of his big speech. Dad looked away. It's a sacrifice, I know, he said. I wish it didn't have to be like this. I didn't say anything about Mom and the plaid suitcase because she'd put it away. That morning I peeked into their bedroom closet. Her clothes were still hanging there, so were Dad's. When I stood up to leave, my father perked up slightly. He said, "Oh, I almost forgot. A reporter from the Island Examiner might drop by the house. It's all right for you to speak with him." "About what?" I asked. "My situation." "Oh, sure, Dad." His situation, I thought. Sometimes it's like my father lives on his own weird little planet. In July, the days get long and stream together. I try not to look at the calendar because I don't want to think about time passing. August comes way too soon, and that's when school starts in Florida. Summer mornings are mostly sunny and still, though by mid-afternoon, huge boiling thunderheads start to build over the Everglades, and the weather can get interesting in a hurry. I've always liked watching the sky drop down like a foamy purple curtain when a summer storm rumbles across Florida Bay. If you're on the ocean side of the islands, it can sneak up on you from behind, which happens a lot to tourists. That's where we were going, to Thunder Beach, when a squall rolled through after lunch. Tom, Rado, and I hunkered in the mangroves and held our skateboards over our heads to keep the raindrops out of our eyes. It took like half an hour for the leading edge of the storm to pass. Then the wind dropped out, and the only sound was a soft, sleepy drizzle. We crawled from the tree line and brushed the leaves off our arms. Not surprisingly, the lightning had spooked everyone away from the park except us. Before heading to the water, we scanned the shoreline for pollution warnings. Whenever the biologists from the health department find too much bacteria, they post danger signs up and down Thunder Beach. No swimming, no fishing, no anything. Only a certified moron would dive in when the beach was posted. I was glad to see that the water was okay, especially when a big loggerhead turtle bobbed up to the surface. The three of us stayed real quiet because we thought the turtle might be coming ashore to lay her eggs, although usually they waited until dark. Loggerheads have lousy eyesight, so we were pretty sure she didn't notice us sitting there, but she didn't swim any closer. We wouldn't have bothered her if she'd decided to crawl up and dig a nest. Most of the keys are made of hard coral rock, and there aren't many soft beaches like you find up the coast at Pompano or Vero. The mama turtles down here don't have a lot of options, so we leave them alone. It's the law, too. After the loggerhead swam off, we jumped in and goofed around until Tom cut his ankle on a broken beer bottle that was buried in the sand. Rado and I helped him hop back to shore, where we tied his Dolphins jersey around his foot to keep the cut from getting dirty. Rado took him home while I skated alone down the old road, back toward Lice Peking's place. Nobody answered the door, and I was already down the steps when Shelley appeared from behind the trailer and nearly scared the you-know-what out of me. She was barefoot and carried a long, rusty shovel. "What do you want now?" she asked. She wore cut-off jeans and a sleeveless top that showed off her barbed wire tattoo. "I need to talk to Mr. Peking again," I said. "Well, he's not available at the moment." "That's okay. I'll come back another time." Shelley noticed me staring at the shovel. She laughed and said, "Don't worry. It wasn't lice I was putting in a hole. It was last night's dinner." I nodded as if it was the most normal thing in the world, burying food in your backyard. "Lobster shells," she explained. "I didn't want them stinking up the garbage, because they're out of season. Next thing you know, some nosy neighbor calls the grouper troopers, and then, Houston, we've got a problem." Some of the locals in the Keys poach a lobster here and there in the off months. Not even my dad gets upset about that. "What you want to talk to lice for?" Shelley asked. "Just some business between him and my father," I said. She was so much taller than me, I had to tilt my head back just to see her expression. She was smiling when she said, "Important business, huh?" "Yes, ma'am." "Come on inside and have something to drink." "No, thanks. I'm soaking wet." "So's lice," Shelley grunted. "But from the inside out." She jerked open the screen door and I followed her into the trailer. Lice Peking was stretched face down on the blue shag carpet and he wasn't moving. I didn't see any blood, which was a relief, but I couldn't hear him breathing. Shelley said, "Oh, don't worry. He's not dead." She gave him a sharp kick to his ribs, and he started to snore. "See?" she said. "Tell me your name again." "Noah Underwood." "Your Payne's oldest?" "That's right," I said. Shelley tossed me a Coke from the refrigerator and said, "Your daddy's a curious specimen." Somehow it sounded like a compliment. I guzzled the soda in about 30 seconds while I edged toward the door. The perfume that Shelley had on was making me dizzy. It smelled like a bag of tangerines.
She sat down on a cane stool and motioned me to do the same, but I stayed on my feet. I wasn't sure what would happen if Lice Peking woke up, and I wanted to be ready to run. Shelley said, I've known Payne since back when he and Dusty used to fish charters out of Ted's. He was always a gentleman. Your daddy, I mean, not Dusty. Yes, ma'am.
How come you're acting so skittery, Noah?
I couldn't come out and tell her that she was the reason, that everything about her, from her face to her feet, was at least twice as big as my mother's. So I said, I'm going to be late for violin practice. Which was incredibly lame, because we don't even own a violin. Abby takes piano lessons on a portable electric keyboard that my father bought from a consignment shop in Key Largo. Now, Noah, Shelley said, that's not the truth, is it? No, ma'am, I'm sorry. Please don't grow up to be one of those men who lie for the sport of it, she said, and most men do. That's a fact. As Shelley spoke, she was staring down at Lice Peking, and not in an admiring way. That's why the world is so messed up, Noah. That's why history books are full of so much heartache and tragedy. Politicians, dictators, kings, phony baloney preachers, most of them men, and most of them lie like rugs, she said. Don't you dare grow up to be like that. At first I thought she was making fun of me, but then I realized she was serious. Your daddy doesn't drink, does he? She said. That's truly amazing. It was sort of unusual for the Keys. People who didn't know my father automatically assumed he had to be drunk to do some of the things he did, but he wasn't. He never touched a drop of alcohol, even on New Year's. It wasn't a religious thing. He just didn't care for the taste. Why can't I find a guy like that? Shelley said in a small voice. I couldn't help but notice that she was using Lice Peking's head as a footrest. Didn't seem to bother him, though. He kept snoring away. You go to public school, she said? Then you must know Jasper Jr. Sure, I said. Is that boy still nasty as a pygmy rattler? Nastier, I answered honestly. Shelley shook her head. He's been that way since he was about 3 foot high. Honestly, I don't see a bright future there. Her mentioning Jasper Jr. reminded me of what my dad said about Shelley and Dusty Muehlman, about how she'd gotten so fed up with him that she'd moved out. I decided to find out if she still felt that way. Didn't you used to work on the Coral Queen, I asked? For almost 3 years, said Shelley. Was it a fun job? She rolled her eyes. Tending bar? Oh, yeah, it was a barrel of laughs. Very glamorous, too. Come on now, what are you driving at? Nothing, I swear. There you go again, Noah. Shelley was sharp when it came to sniffing out fibs, so I just came out and asked her. Did you ever hear about anything crooked going on with that boat? Crooked how? She asked. Like dumping sewer water into the basin? She laughed in a way that sounded hard and bitter. Sweetie, she said, the only sewage I ever saw was the human kind. That's what you call the downside of my job. Oh. This has something to do with your old man, doesn't it? About him sinking Dusty's boat. Maybe. It sounded silly as soon as I said it. Maybe almost always meant yes. Okay, let's hear the whole story. Shelley cocked her head and cupped one of her ears, which had like 5 silver rings on it. Come on, Noah, she said. I'm listening. There was no way I wasn't going to cave in and blab everything. She was a pro at shaking the truth out of guys who were a lot bigger and tougher than I was. But then Lice Peking came to the rescue. He stopped snoring, flopped over on his back, and opened one bleary red eye. Shelley thumped him with both heels and said, Get up, you sorry sack of beans, before I park that slimy aquarium on your head. I didn't wait around to see if she was serious. 4. The next morning, the lawyer stopped by our house. Mr. Shine looked about 1,000 years old, but Mom said he knew his way around the courthouse. She had hired him twice before to get my father out of trouble. Mr. Shine put his briefcase on the kitchen table and sat down. He looked mopey and gray, and his eyelids drooped. Abby said he reminded her of Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. My mother made a pot of coffee and began dropping hints that Abby and I should leave them alone. Abby grabbed a bagel out of the toaster and ran off to play on the computer. I got my spinning rod from the garage and biked up to the drawbridge at Snake Creek. The police won't let you fish from the top of the bridge because of the traffic, but you can go down underneath and cast from the sandbags in the shade. Sometimes homeless people sleep under the bridges, but they usually don't bother anybody. The last time I'd been to Snake Creek, some woman in an army jacket had made a campsite high on the bank, under the concrete braces.
She'd even started a small fire, burning the wood slats from a broken stone crab trap. I gave her a nice mangrove snapper that I caught, and she had it cleaned and cooking over the flames in 5 minutes flat. She said it was the best meal she'd eaten in a year. The next day, Abby and I went back with some homemade bread and a pound of fresh Gulf shrimp. But the lady was gone. I never even got her name. On the day Mom was meeting with Mr. Shine, nobody was under the bridge when I got there. The tide was running in from the ocean, and schools of finger mullet were holding in the still water behind the pilings. Every so often, they'd start jumping, trying to escape some bigger fish that was prowling for lunch. I started casting a white bucktail, and in no time jumped a baby tarpon that wasn't even 10 pounds. Then I hooked something heavy, probably a snook, that ran out 100 feet and broke the line. As I was tying on another jig, I heard an outboard engine. It was a John boat, maybe 12 feet long, motoring along Snake Creek. Two people were in the boat, and as it drew closer, I recognized them as Jasper Jr. and an older kid named Bull. They spotted me right away. I probably should have taken off, but I was really enjoying myself, fishing under that bridge. So I set down my spinning rod and watched Jasper Jr. nose the John boat into the shallows. Bull was in the bow. He climbed out first and looped a rope around one of the pilings. He's a hefty guy, but that's not how he got his nickname. People call him Bull because you can't believe a word he says. For instance, he told everyone at school he was dropping out to play double-A ball for the Baltimore Orioles. This is at age 16, right? We all knew that Bull couldn't catch a pop fly if it landed in his lap, so we weren't exactly surprised to see him bagging groceries that spring at the Winn-Dixie. After Bull tied off the John boat, he called up to me.
Hey, Buttface! Better run for your life! Jasper's got a spear gun!
Yeah, right, I said. When Jasper Jr. hopped out of the boat, I saw that he didn't have a spear gun or any other weapon. Even so, running away would have been an excellent idea. I just didn't feel like it. Jasper Jr. walked up and asked, "What are you looking at?" "Absolutely nothing," I said with a straight face.
"I told you I was going to find you, didn't I?"
I knew that Jasper Jr. wasn't looking for me at Snake Creek. He and Bull were heading out to poach lobsters or pull some other mischief. But I played along. "Well, you found me. Now what?" That's when he socked me in the right eye. It hurt, too. Jasper Jr. seemed surprised that I didn't fall down. So was Bull. He said, "You got a hard head for a butt face." The way my cheekbone was throbbing, I figured that Jasper Jr.'s knuckles weren't feeling so good either. He was trying to act like a tough guy, but I noticed that his eyes were watering from the pain. I probably could have knocked him flat, but I didn't. My father's a large man, very strong, but he says fighting is for people who can't win with their brains. He also says there are times when you've got no choice but to defend yourself from common morons. If Jasper Jr. had taken another swing at me, I definitely would have punched him back. Then Bull would have beaten me to a pulp and the whole thing would have been over. But Jasper Jr. didn't hit me again. Instead, he spit in my face, which was worse in a way. He forced a laugh and called me a couple of dirty names and headed back toward the John boat. He was shaking the hand that he'd hit me with, as if there were a crab or a mousetrap attached to it. Bull was following behind, cackling like a hyena. They got into the boat, and Jasper Jr. jerk-started the outboard while Bull shoved off from the bow. I pulled up the front of my shirt and wiped the spit off my face. Then I grabbed my fishing rod and took aim. The bucktail jig I happened to be using weighed 1/4 of an ounce, which doesn't sound like much until it thumps you between the shoulder blades, which is where I thumped Jasper Jr. It was an awesome cast, I've got to admit. The hook on the jig snagged firmly in the mesh of Jasper Jr.'s ratty old basketball jersey, and he let out a howl. I gave a stiff yank, and he howled again. In a panic, he twisted the throttle, and the John boat picked up speed. But that didn't help. Jasper Jr. was stuck on the end of my line like a moray eel. He hollered for Bull to cut him loose, which was all right with me. I'd made my point. Bull found a knife and clambered to the back end of the boat, which turned out to be a humongous mistake. With so much weight in the stern, Bull, Jasper Jr., plus the engine, the bow tilted upward and the John boat began taking on water. No sooner had Bull reached behind Jasper Jr. to cut the fishing line than the motor gurgled to a dead stop. The blue-green water of Snake Creek was pouring in over the transom, but nobody in the John boat moved. Jasper Jr. was yelling at Bull and Bull was yelling back, and they just kept getting wetter and wetter. By now the motor was completely submerged and the bow was pointed nearly straight up in the air. which meant that the boat was about to capsize. Bull was the first to jump, with Jasper Jr. right behind him. They started swimming like maniacs toward the bumpers of the bridge, cursing the whole way. They were making such an awful racket that the mullet scattered out of the eddies, and I knew that the fishing was pretty much shot for the afternoon. So I reeled in my line and made my way up the slope toward the highway.
You did what? Abby said when I told her what happened. Geez, you're as whacked as Dad.
I didn't sink their stupid boat. They sunk it themselves. Abby muttered in exasperation.
If this keeps up, we're going to get run out of town. Mom will have to put the house up for sale.
Jasper Jr. spit on me, I said. What happened to your eye? He did that, too. After examining my bruise, Abby seemed more sympathetic. From now on, don't go anywhere without Tom or Rado, she advised. It would have been a sensible plan, except that Tom's family was heading to North Carolina for the rest of the summer, and Rado was going camping in Colorado with his mother and stepdad. Tom and Rado were my best friends, and without them, I was basically on my own. Mom came into the bedroom, and the first thing she noticed, naturally, was my black eye. I told her the whole story. Abby hung around to make sure. My mother was real angry, but I begged her not to call Dusty Muleman and tell him what Jasper Jr. had done. It'll just make things worse, I said.
What could be worse than getting punched and spit at? She asked.
Lots of things. Trust me, Mom. Noah's right, Abby said. We'll discuss this later. My mother's mouth wasn't moving much when she talked, which meant she was still mad. Noah, please go wash up. There's a gentleman waiting in the living room to speak with you. Who is it? I asked. Is he from the police?
No,
from the newspaper, Mom said, making that sound even worse. Apparently your father thought it would be a brilliant idea to have an article written about himself. He sent a reporter here to interview you. Abby rolled her eyes. You've got to be joking. I wish I were, said my mother. Hurry up, Noah, and put on a clean shirt, please. I don't want you looking like some sort of juvenile delinquent.
Then you ought to put some makeup on a shiner, Abby suggested.
No way, I said.
But it was too late. The reporter's name was Miles Umlat. He was thin and blotchy, and his nose was scuffed up like an old shoe. Mom had stationed him on the sofa so he could set up his tape recorder on the coffee table. On his lap, he held a lined yellow pad that was covered with scribbles. I sat down in the tall armchair where my father usually sits. Mom had dabbed some flesh-colored powder around my black eye, and she must have done a good job because Miles Umlat didn't seem to notice. He asked what grade I was in, what sort of hobbies I enjoyed, did I own a dog or a cat, the usual stuff. He was pretending to be nice, but I could tell it was a real chore. He was dying to get to the juicy parts. I understand you've been to visit your father, he said finally. That must have been tough.
Not really. I was trying to sound kind of cool and bored.
Yes, well, this isn't the first time your dad's had a scrape with the law, is it?
No, sir.
What do you remember about the other times, he asked.
I just shrugged.
It was amazing that Mom had left me alone in the room with this guy. I knew she was hovering somewhere nearby, but at least for now, I was free to say what I wanted.
I found an old clipping about the Carmichael family, Miles Umlat said. He held up the photocopy to show me.
That was a long time ago, I said.
Only 3 years.
Are you sure? I asked, although 3 years sounded about right.
Here's what had happened, the way my father told it. The Carmichaels drove their 40-foot gas-hogging motor home all the way to the Keys from someplace up in Michigan. They were too cheap to rent space at an RV park, so they parked along Highway 1 near the Indian Key Bridge and camped there for 3 nights. Which would have been no big deal, except for the way they treated their dogs. They had 2 chocolate Labrador retrievers that rode along with them in the motorhome. One morning, my dad was heading out on a tarpon fishing charter when he spotted Mr. Carmichael whipping the dogs with a bungee cord. I guess the dogs had had an accident inside the Winnebago or something. Anyhow, they were crying and yipping and trying to get away, but Mrs. Carmichael, who was the size of a whale, was standing on their leashes so that Mr. Carmichael could beat them. When Dad saw that, he sort of freaked. He beached the skiff, took out his tarpon gaff, and flattened every single tire. I think there were like 8 of them on the Carmichael's RV. Then he put the 2 Labradors in his boat and went fishing. The sheriff's deputies were waiting on the dock at the end of the day. My father confessed right away, as he always does, but he wouldn't apologize. He also wouldn't say what he'd done with the dogs because he knew they'd be safer away from the Carmichaels. That time, Dad spent only 2 nights in jail before he let Mom bail him out. Eventually, he pleaded guilty to vandalism and, I guess, dog napping,
although he agreed to pay for the Labradors and a new set of Winnebago tires. Later, we found out that Dad probably would have beaten the charges because the Carmichaels had refused to come back to the Keys for a trial. They wrote a letter to the judge saying that my father was a raving lunatic and they were scared to be in the same county with him, which was ridiculous. Anyway, my dad said that running those puppy-whipping lowlifes out of the islands was worth the legal hassle. A public service is what he called it. The two chocolate labs ended up with some friends of ours, nice people who ran an Italian restaurant down in Marathon. I listened while Miles Umlaut went through the whole story again. Dad just lost his temper, I said when he was done. But those people were wrong. It's against the law to treat animals like that. Miles Umlaut wrote that down on his pad, which made me a little nervous. So did the tiny green light blinking on his tape recorder. Dad's just gotta work on his self-control, I added. Are you ever afraid of him? I burst out laughing. It was such a lame question. Afraid of my dad? You serious? Well, Noah, you've got to admit, Miles Umlaut said. His behavior's been erratic. Unpredictable, I mean. I knew perfectly well what erratic meant. Dad wouldn't hurt a flea, I said firmly. But would he hurt a human who would hurt a flea? That's when Mom breezed in to refill Miles Umlaut's coffee cup, or at least that was her excuse. How's it going, fellas? She asked. Just fine, Mrs. Underwood, said Miles Umlaut. Noah's a bright young man. I felt like sticking my finger down my throat. Mom flashed her fake polite smile and said, yes, we're very proud of him. She hung around for a while, making small talk, until the phone rang in the kitchen. As soon as we were alone again, Miles Umlaut leaned forward and said, Noah, what can you tell me about the incident with Derek Mays? Not much. I was sure he already knew the whole story. Everybody in the Upper Keys did. And what he didn't know, he could have found out from the Coast Guard files. Derek says he was afraid for his life, Miles Umlaut said. Maybe he was just afraid of getting busted. Here's what my dad said had happened. He was out bone fishing with two doctors from New Jersey when he spotted Derek May stringing a gillnet near Little Rabbit Key. Gillnets were outlawed years ago in Florida because they kill everything that gets tangled, not just the bait fish, but sharks, reds, snook, tarpon, turtles, you name it, it dies. To make things worse, the island where Derek Mays was poaching was deep in Everglades National Park, which is totally protected, or supposed to be. When he spotted my father, Derek hauled in the gillnet and made a run for it. Dad's skiff is super quick, and it didn't take long for him to catch up. Derek refused to stop, so my father leaped right into his boat. Then it turned into a wrestling match, and things got ugly. By the time the park rangers arrived, Dad had wrapped up Derek in his own net like a big dumb mullet. But here's the part that really got to me. Not a darn thing happened to Derek because none of the rangers actually witnessed what he was doing at Little Rabbit. Meanwhile, Dad gets accused of, like, assault, and then the government takes away his captain's license because, they said, he endangered the lives of his customers by chasing after Derek at high speed. Of course, the two doctors on Dad's boat said they'd never had so much fun, but that didn't count for squat with the Coast Guard. Which is why my father had to start driving a cab. Miles Umlaut said, "There seems to be a pattern to these episodes, wouldn't you say?" "It's not like it happens every day," I said. The guy was definitely getting on my nerves. I was sort of annoyed at my father for choosing me to be the one for the interview. The only reason I knew was that Mom had refused to do it. "Let's talk about what happened to the Coral Queen," said Miles Umlaut, and he droned through that whole story. He told me that Dusty Muehlman denied flushing polluted water from his gambling boat, which was no big surprise. Why would he ever admit to the crime? "He threatened to sue your father for slander," Miles Umlaut said. "What's that?" "Saying something bad about a person that isn't true." "Dad doesn't lie," I said. "He might do some crazy stuff, but he always tells the truth." "Are you proud of him, Noah?" That was a tricky one. I wasn't proud that my dad was sitting in jail, but I knew he was a good person. Even when he flies off the handle, at least he's fighting for something close to his heart. Too many people these days, they just turn their backs or close their eyes, pretending everything is wonderful in the world. Well, it's not. "I am proud of my father," I said to Miles Umlaut, "for standing up for what he believes. But, like I said, once in a while he goes too far." Miles Umlaut jotted down every word. "Your dad said he considers himself a political prisoner. Would you agree with that?" Political prisoner, I thought. Give me a break. I knew Mom wasn't eavesdropping because she would have blown a fuse. "I don't know much about politics," I said carefully. but he's definitely a prisoner. Miles Umlaut seemed to think that was very funny. He wrote it down, closed his notebook, and switched off his tape recorder. "Thank you, Noah. That was perfect," he said. Then he shook my hand and skittered out the front door. My mother was still on the phone in the kitchen. She gave me a thumbs-up signal when I came in to grab some cookies. On the way to my room, I stopped outside Abby's doorway and listened. She was crying, which got me worried because my sister hardly ever cries. I opened the door to check on her. She was sitting on the edge of the bed with a box of Kleenex on her lap and a pile of pink crumpled-up tissues on the floor. I could tell she was really upset because she didn't holler at me for barging in without knocking. "What's wrong?" I asked. "It's Mom," she sniffled. "But I just saw her. She seemed okay." Abby shook her head. "The lawyer, Shine," she was trying to catch her breath between sobs. "What about him? He won't take Dad's case?" Worse, Abby stammered. I heard Mom ask him... Here she paused to snatch another tissue and dab at her eyes. "Ask him what?" I said impatiently. She didn't know I was standing by the door. "Abby, it's all right. Calm down, okay?" "Okay." She straightened up and swallowed hard, and for a moment she looked like her old brave self. "Now tell me," I said, "what was Mom asking Mr. Shine about?" "The D word," my sister whispered. "Divorce?" Abby nodded. Her lower lip began to tremble and her shoulders went kind of slack. So I sat on the bed and put one arm around her and tried to act stronger than I felt. 5. Everybody was quiet at breakfast the next morning. Mom said she was taking Abby shopping. I told her I was going fishing again, which was a possibility. First, though, I had to have another talk with my father. I wanted him to know that Mom had mentioned the D word. Surely that would shake him up enough to come home. As soon as Mom and Abby left, I got on my bike and headed up the highway toward the jail. I wasn't sure they'd let me in without Mom calling to arrange it, so I brought along a letter that had arrived for my father at the house. It was from the U.S. State Department, and the seal on the envelope made it look very important. I already knew what the letter said because my mother had opened it. The government was telling us, for about the 15th time, that the body of Robert Lee Underwood, my grandpa Bobby, was still down in Columbia. They couldn't bring him home because there was a problem with the paperwork, and the police in the village were not responding to inquiries from the United States Embassy. The news wasn't going to cheer up Dad, but at least it gave me an excuse to see him again. When I showed the envelope to the deputy at the desk, he didn't seem very impressed. He peeked inside to make sure that it was only a letter, and he said he'd give it to my father later. "Can't I give it to him myself?" I asked. "No, he's busy this morning," the deputy said. "Busy," I thought. "Doing what, pretending to play chess?" "Is he all right?" I said. The deputy chuckled. "Yeah, he's fine. There's a TV crew that drove down from Miami to see him."
"TV?"
"Yeah, Channel 10. They said they'll be needing at least an hour." "Then I'll come back later," I said. The deputy shook his head. "Sorry, sport. Inmates are allowed only one short visit per day, and we're already bending the rules for this TV thing. Maybe tomorrow you can see your old man, but call first, okay?" Sure enough, there was a shiny new van from Channel 10 parked outside the sheriff's station. I don't know why I hadn't noticed it before. I rode away wondering how to tell my mother that Dad was now doing television interviews from jail. She'd find out sooner or later when it was on the news, because all the Miami TV stations broadcast to the Keys. So I'd have to tell her, even though she wouldn't be happy about it. Maybe Dad thought of himself as a political prisoner, but Mom thought he was being a selfish jerk. Lice Peaking was actually awake and semi-alert when I stopped at the trailer. Shelley wasn't there, which was sort of a relief and a disappointment at the same time. She made me real nervous, but she also kept Lice Peaking from acting up. "Well, looky who's here," he said with a wormy smile. He was lounging on the front stoop, sucking on a cigarette. His hair was wet and tangly, and his shirt was damp. I couldn't tell whether he'd taken a shower or sprayed himself down with a garden hose. "So, how's the jailbird?" he asked. "Oh, that's real funny." I didn't appreciate him talking that way about my dad. It was different when Abby did it because she was family. Lice Peaking was just a lazy lump who didn't know anything about my father.
"Well, what'd he say?" Lice Peaking asked. "Can he come up with some money or not?"
I said, "We don't have any money, but he'll give you his flat skiff. It's worth $12,000. Lice Peaking squinted one bloodshot eye.
Says who?
Come see for yourself. It's on a trailer behind our house. I told him what kind of boat it was and that the engine had fewer than 100 hours on it.
Serious?